This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last weekend, the Democratic caucus in the Vermont House officially nominated their candidate to be the next House Speaker. Two Democrats had been lobbying colleagues for their votes, but when it became clear that she didn't have enough, Sarah Copeland-Hanza stepped down and threw her support behind Mitzi Johnson. Johnson is a 14-year veteran of the House and became chair of the Appropriations Committee last year. Her district is made up of the Champlain Islands and part of the town of Milton on the mainland. She'll be up against Republican Linda Myers of Essex in the election in January, but Democrats control 84 seats in the 150-seat chamber, so Johnson is widely expected to win. Today on the program, we're going to talk about Johnson's priorities for the legislature this coming session and learn a little bit more about how she plans to lead the House. Mitzi Johnson, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much, Jane. Pleasure to be here.
Why did you want this job? Why do you want to be House Speaker?
For 10 years, I've been on the Appropriations Committee balancing the state budget. And, it hasn't been an easy job any of the last 10 years. But we have done a lot of work to institute a more integrated view of the budget, integrating policy and budget work, and really trying to set in place a system of prioritization so that we can make sure the budget reflects Vermonters' needs. And it felt like we were ready with all of the work that's been done in the administration and the legislature. It just feels like we're ready for a big growth spurt on how to do that. And I'd like to lead that from the Speaker's office.
Why not just from the Appropriations Committee? Why not stay there and lead it, since that's a money committee really focusing on the budget? What can you do you think, in the Speaker's chair or with the Speaker's voice that you couldn't do from that committee?
The Speaker is responsible for setting up all of the committees, assigning chairs, vice chairs, and committee members. And so from the Speaker's office, I can set up a committee that is committed to reviewing their area of state government, really evaluating and prioritizing. I can make sure that there is the training and support for legislators to be able to ask the right questions and do that work. In the Speaker's office, I would have closer ties and a closer working relationship with the administration to be able to do that work together.
We're talking with Grand Isle Representative Mitzi Johnson. And listeners, if you have a question for her, our number is 1-800-639-2211. We're going to talk about a lot of things, including her priorities for the legislative session that's about to start. The vote won't happen until the legislature is in session, but she has been formally nominated by the Democratic caucus now and is widely expected to win. So if you have a question for the likely next House Speaker, again, 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a question from Kathy in East Montpelier who says, what was the basis of your campaign for Speaker? Did you advocate for particular areas of legislation or a style of leadership? Why do you think you won and Representative Copeland-Hanza lost?
That's a great question. So as I just mentioned, my real focus was on a process of evaluation and prioritization. Most Speaker candidates do run around and say, here are the top issues that I want us to work on. And that's kind of the standard way it's done. And I was frustrated by the standard way and felt like what we really need is a better way to look at what state government does, how well we're doing it, and really look at what Vermonters need to see if what government is offering and what Vermonters needs are really aligning. I think the legislature could be a much better, more independent branch of government. We are effectively the board of directors for the state of Vermont. So I went around and drove all over the state talking with my Democratic colleagues because the first step was a Democratic caucus nomination, and talked with my Democratic colleagues and said, I don't have – of course I have policy opinions. I wouldn't be in this line of work if I didn't. But what I am offering is a plan for a process that allows Vermonters' priorities and needs to come through so we can really integrate where we put our policy energy and where we put our financial resources.
As you said, one of the ways that you can do that as House Speaker is by assigning committee positions and who's on what committee. And that's really the first job you have when you get into the legislature in January. The House Speaker makes those committee assignments. So Are you likely to shake things up? Are we going to see people who are moved around from where they were before? I know you also have quite a few new members to assign. But, you know, what does that actually look like when you talk about changing the way those committee assignments are made or how those committees actually operate?
It's assigning those committees is a very complicated Tetris kind of puzzle. There are 150 members that Vermonters send to the legislature. Every one of them has to be assigned to one committee and no more in the House. Senators are on two committees.
And there are 14 committees?
13.
13.
And we have, you know, there's a lot of experience. So I made no promises during the campaign.
I was going to ask, I mean, was that a bargaining chip that people say? Because you go and you basically say, I'd like you to support me to be the next Speaker of the House in that official nominating process. And I imagine committee assignments would be a big part of that discussion of whether or not you're going to get somebody's support. But you didn't promise anybody any committee assignments?
So there are that is certainly a technique that is used out there. I made it really clear to people that if I was offering a trade, you know, their speaker vote for my promise of a committee assignment, then frankly they shouldn't believe me on any of the other platform, which was really about objective evaluation of state government. And I'm committed to making sure that committees are set up to be productive, to have a mix of skills and experience, and so that those committees can really do the best work for the state of Vermont. So no, I did not make any promises. I did tell people that I firmly believe that shakeup and change is really good for a system. I think it helps us see things differently. It helps change up dynamics. But I want to acknowledge that there is a lot of change in this system we're working in already. There's a new governor, new lieutenant governor, new Senate pro tem, new speaker, new caucus leadership in the House, a shakeup of some of the caucus leadership for the Republicans, new leadership for the progressives. We have a huge number of new Democrats, and all over within the House with the new independents, progressives and Republicans, there are a lot of new members. And because we have a new governor, almost all of our secretaries and commissioners will be brand new. So there's already a lot of change in the system.
Can you, just so I have a better sense of what you are thinking you may do with committee assignments, can you give me an example of how something might change or what you're looking for to be different in the way committees operate so that you do have both that freshness that you're talking about, but also the most efficient and effective way to lead the state?
Sure. There are some committees where a significant number of people have left the committee. On the Ways and Means Committee that raises money or looks at fees and taxes, all but one of the Republicans retired from the House or ran for the Senate. In the Government Operations Committee, all but one of the Democrats left. In the House Human Services Committee, a bipartisan mix of a mass exodus occurred. And there are some committees where every single member returned. You know, I think the Commerce Committee, everybody that was on the Commerce Committee last year returned. So I can't put, for the committees that did have a lot of vacancies, I can't put five or six brand new members on that committee that don't have institutional knowledge and don't have a strong understanding of how the House works. So I'm going to have to shuffle around some existing returning legislators so that we have a little even distribution. People's interests may shift too. They may decide they want to be on a different committee. Right now we're in the process of offering all members of the House an opportunity to write to the speaker candidates and say, here's what my skills are, here's where I think I could be of most use, and here's what I'd like. The other way I'm looking at this is I think this sort of time with a lot of change is a great opportunity to say, let's look at where all our resources are going, where some of the topics are concerned, and are there places where there's a topic that's gained more traction in the last 10 or 12 years since committee jurisdictions have been looked at very closely. And can that be covered? And for me, looking at IT and how the legislature evaluates IT projects and looks at the accessibility of IT and telecom issues, I think, you know, could use a little more focus.
Yeah, which has been a huge thorn in the side of the state as these Sure. IT projects have not gone according to plan or have gone over budget or have just not worked well for the state. So that does seem to be a big issue for whichever committee winds up taking it on sort of whole hog.
Right. And, of course, we can all name, you know, the big examples of failure there. But most people can't name some pretty significant projects that came in on time, under budget. And so also being able to look at those, of course, we never hear about them because they went well, right? So to being able to look at those and say, how did those work? And how can we replicate that is equally important.
Again, we're talking today with Mitzi Johnson, who's likely to become Speaker of the House when the legislature convenes next month. And if you have a question for her, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Cecile is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Cecile. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, we hear you. Hi, Cecile.
Oh, great. Okay, I'm sorry. So I am a small business owner in Montpelier, and I really support paid family leave so that people can take care of new babies or aging parents or a family member who maybe has a disability. It would be very hard for me personally to financially float that. And I know that several states have looked at ways of the state funding a paid family leave program. And I'm wondering if that's something that you would support and if you can speak to whether you might make that a priority.
Thanks for the call, Cecile. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Cecile. Certainly, when we talk about how to create a strong, healthy future for Vermont, having robust small businesses is a key part of that. And making sure that families, the kind of demographic that we really want to attract and establish in the state, has making sure that those young families can have a good start and that small children have a really good start. So certainly looking at ways to create that strong, healthy future for Vermont is one of the overarching questions we'll be asking. And where specific policies and proposals are concerned, this is where I was telling Jane just a little bit ago that it's really important for me to create a strong process across the legislature, across the House, that looks at what we're doing, where we're falling down on the job, and what Vermonters need to create a strong priority list. I think there are quite a few people talking about a family leave kind of bill so that for people that are not familiar with it, there could be a more defined period where new parents or people with aging parents or an aging or, you know, ill family member could have that time to take care of those people in early childhood. It's really important to have that bonding period, and it's really important for a parent to know that their child is well taken care of. It's important for employers to have employees who are focused on their work and not scrambling around for child care.
But of course, Cecile's asking specifically about state funded, it sounds like a state run program for paid family leave, because through the federal law, the Family Medical Leave Act, you can get 12 weeks of unpaid leave to care for a sick family member or a new baby. But it sounds like Cecile says, I'm a small business owner, I can't float that payment on my own. Is that something the state would consider? And it sounds like you're not committing either way on that.
I'm not committing either way because it's something that, again, we've got to have the legislature and you know, where I have a little more influence in the House, look at the priority list, you know, and develop their own priority list. I can walk in with my own and impose it on people, but that's not terribly democratic of me. So really looking at that and looking at, you know, we're gonna have a tough budget year. And so looking at what we already fund and looking at what we don't fund and seeing which things are most important to us. You know, whatever we can have all kinds of conversations about what the right level of spending or taxation is, but whatever level we choose, the budget is a fairly defined box. And the things that make it into that box are, by default, our priorities for investment. So I look forward to setting up a system where the policy committees that know each of these pieces of, you know, economic development and family supports best can look and say, what are the best ways to use Vermonters' resources for investing in our future?
We have listeners who have questions about specific areas of policy and areas of lawmaking, and I want to get to those, and specifically talking a little bit about property taxes and education funding. But just before we leave this topic, Representative Johnson, it does sound like you're espousing a kind of a pretty big shift then in how you see the Speaker's role, because as a leader in the House, the Speaker, and certainly Shep Smith, has advocated for certain policies or certain things he'd like to see the legislature do, you know, things that he says, I feel very strongly about this. You know, we knew where he stood on marijuana legalization and when his policy ideas changed. You know, there were a lot of big topics that we knew exactly how he felt and what he wanted the legislature to do. And you don't seem to be following that same path in terms of saying, these are the things that I want to see the legislature get done.
I think that's right. I think one of the earlier callers mentioned, you know, a question about my leadership style. And if you've watched what you've gotten out of me so far as chair of appropriations and my leadership style there, it engages a whole lot of listening and a whole lot of trying to figure out what the whole team needs. And we have a large, very wide team, both within the Democratic caucus and within the legislature as a whole. So really trying to see what that team needs and what our constituents and our communities want us to represent is a really important piece of this job, particularly in my first year, should I be elected in January.
More to come with Mitzi Johnson, including, as I said, we're going to talk about property taxes and ed funding and other topics that are important to you. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or pose a question on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Mitzi Johnson is a Democratic representative from Grand Isle and chair of the House Appropriations Committee. She's the likely next Speaker of the House as well, and she's our guest today as we discuss priorities and where she sees the Democratic caucus focusing its energy in the coming session, which starts in less than a month. What questions do you have for Representative Johnson? Call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's go to David, who's calling in from Barrie. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so I'm a young Vermonter. I've seen a lot of job growth here in Vermont in the last few years, particularly in renewable energy and other businesses and organizations here. So I guess I just wanted to know how you thought we can continue on this track to have more job growth, particularly in renewable energy and other sectors that have been growing here, to help Vermont continue to be appealing to young Vermonters like me.
Thanks for the call, David.
David, that's a really terrific question because that's, you know, you're the kind of person that we want to make sure is attracted to Vermont and finds a real solid home and roots in a community. I think one of the things we have to do is really take a look at what younger people are really looking for. I think what I heard from a lot of folks out on the campaign trail, both in my own reelection and in the speaker campaign, was looking at just broadband, cell phone, you know, those sort of things that are becoming basics to some people that we still, like many other states, don't have full coverage on. So continuing that work, I think a lot of we have a lot of mechanisms in place for renewable energy. And so making sure that we don't back down on those kinds of things. we have gone from one of the New England states with the highest utility rates to the one of the lowest utility rates, and I think that's in part because of some of the investments we made. So I think that's a wonderful example of overlap between something that's a bit of a magnet for people interested in that, but also really speaks to making sure that people can pay their bills.
Let's go to Timothy calling in from East Berkshire. Hi, Timothy. What are you thinking about?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, real quick about the property tax issue. Will you folks in Montpelier be focusing on some type of property tax reform? I feel, given my experience with the whole thing, that I find it to be a very highly subjective process. The parameters, if you will, seem to be very vague, very nebulous, so to speak. And we just pay so much in property taxes. Is there anything that you folks are going to focus upon to try to mitigate that?
Timothy, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call. We also got a question from John in South Stratford who says, last week on Vermont Edition's Look at Act 46, it was explained that this bill's purpose was education equity, not tax relief. How do you plan to address the problem of high educational property taxes in Vermont? And of course, we just saw Vermont's tax commissioner last week come out with a report suggesting that Vermonters' educational property tax bills could be increased by about 2.35% on average next year. And of course, that all depends on what's decided at the local level. But what about this question of high property taxes that people feel like they're really suffering from?
It's certainly a huge issue in my district as well. And Vermont has... We have a few unique distinctions here. We are more heavily reliant on the property tax for education funding than almost any other state, I believe any other state. We also have a quarter. I don't think people fully realize that a quarter of the entire general fund just goes straight to the education fund. That and healthcare are our two biggest expenditures out of the general fund. It's obviously a critical investment to make for a strong, healthy future in Vermont. So one of the things that we've worked to set up in the past is getting better, more consistent information from schools to have a better understanding of what's this money going to, what is the investment, and what kind of results are we getting for that investment. So with the property tax. When that question comes up, we have to look at two questions. One is what is the formula, and how are we distributing that? How we raise the money. Right now, as I said, it's very heavily dependent on the property tax. The other question is how much is being spent, and what are we spending it on? Are we getting our money's worth, and is it the right investment to be making? And we have some very strong schools in Vermont, and you know, kids get a good education. Act 46 was really about kind of spreading out that opportunity for to be able to make sure that kids had access to the same types of classes and the same types of opportunities. It's definitely a question that I've wrestled with a lot. If it had been easy to answer, we would have answered it a long time ago.
But you're open to changing the funding formula?
I'm absolutely open to changing the funding formula.
Do you envision it relying less heavily on property taxes?
I think nobody disagrees with that vision out there. It's just figuring out how to make it happen, because to make it rely less on property taxes, it means we either have to cut some other expenditure that's, you know, in the budget for a reason, maybe cuttable, but that's a very hard choice, or we have to raise a different tax in order to lower the property taxes. We get caught in this very complicated conversation between the boundaries placed upon us by the Supreme Court in the Brigham decision, the legislature, which decides the funding formula and some of the parameters and requirements of education along with the federal government, and local school boards and voters that actually decide how much is spent. And so there isn't a real clear chain of command there. the PICUS report for any education funding and quality geeks out there like myself. The PICUS report talks about how if we just moved up from, you know, 4.5-ish students per adult, that's not teacher, but all adults in the classroom, mm-hmm. up to 5 students per adult, it'll save us $70 million. And that sounds like, oh, great, fabulous, right? Why wouldn't we? Except to do that, we have to get 300-ish school boards across the state to each squeeze an adult out of their system. And that's where it gets really complicated, particularly when we have so many small, vibrant community schools that don't really have a choice about how many second graders show up, you know, to class in September. It gets very complicated very quickly.
While we're on this subject, let's go to Heather, who's calling in from North Bennington. Hi, Heather. Your question.
Hi. Good day. How are you?
Great.
I'm calling to wonder what your approach to education in Vermont is, in particular with school choice. I know down here in southwestern Vermont, there's a lot of Democrats that actually voted for a Republican for governor this time around because they're feeling like they're not having the choices available to their children, and they're not in a position to send their children to private schools. Public schools don't. They're not a one-size-fits-all, and every child is not served by them. And Phil Scott has said that he would look into expanding choice. Act 46 certainly seems to be reducing choice. I'm wondering what your stance is on that, and hopefully it'll be for choice.
Sure. So I would say that Act 46, I would disagree that Act 46 is reducing choice because that decision still resides in the communities. You know, depending on how communities and school districts want to combine, they can retain that or not. There are mergers occurring in my neck of the woods and other places where they have been constructed to be able to retain that choice. There are, you know, one of my communities is also also actually turned down choice. They refused to be a part of a merger because keeping their 7th and 8th grades were really important to that community in South Hero. So I think that is still – that piece where Act 46 is concerned is still very much up to what the individual communities are looking into. And so I would say that we need to make sure that we're educating all of Vermont's kids. We have a responsibility to all of them, and creating, you know, creating those kinds of various educational opportunities so that kids can get what they need, and that we have a strong, vibrant public school system, so that you know, many kids that can't that aren't from families that that can afford a private school, that they can still get that strong opportunity and to create that future that they need.
You mentioned that working on the educational funding model is always something that the legislature is looking at, trying to figure out a good way of doing it. Are there other specific issues as Speaker of the House that you would instruct or hope that the House would be looking at? I mean, even if you're not taking a very specific position on certain issues, are there ones that you see definitely coming up and you definitely want the House to be looking at?
I think, you know, rather than naming a you know, specific issue, I tend to think more in terms of what are the factors affecting our state right now that we need to pay attention to. And so I think that's, you know, what we've seen in property tax trends sort of leads me to that thought about needing to just make sure that we have that, you know, looking at ways to improve that system. One of the other trends that troubles me quite a bit is looking at our economy and how Vermont has recovered from the recession. When you look at charts looking at Vermont as a whole, we have an enviably low unemployment rate. We were the first state to see a median income jump. I think overall there you can see on average average. It's improving. When you start breaking that data out, either by tax bracket or regionally, what you see is that there are pockets. There are pockets doing well, and but we really need to take a strong look at the state as a whole. You know, we want to make sure that rural Vermont has the job opportunities, that has business growth opportunities, that has access to higher education and child care. And, you know, so I think making sure that we've got that economic growth and those opportunities spread out all over the state is going to be really important for us to look at.
How do you expect your relationship to go with the governor-elect Phil Scott?
I'm expecting a really good working relationship. I worked well with people across party lines as chair of the Appropriations Committee. In my 2 years as chair there, was able to get three unanimous votes, bipartisan votes, on very contentious budgets out of the committee, and one 10-1 vote. I have Republicans that have encouraged me to run for speaker. So I'm very comfortable with what that relationship's going to be, and I look forward to working with him.
Have you guys chatted yet, now that you're the official nominee of the Democratic caucus?
Exchanged messages and haven't buckled down yet.
Well, there's certainly time for that come
January.
There will be. Mitzi Johnson is a Democratic representative from Grand Isle and the likely next Vermont Speaker of the House. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont just announced that it's receiving federal funds to hire an attorney whose focus will be exclusively on civil rights. We'll talk with that lawyer and hear more from the office next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Vermont has a new attorney, and her whole position is focused on civil rights issues and cases. Julia Torti is taking that position. The Department of Justice made this job available in Vermont and 33 other states around the country, all of whom bid for the federal funding. Nicholas Karest is the civil chief and civil rights coordinator for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Vermont. He goes by the name of Colo. When I spoke with him and Jules Torti, the new U.S. assistant attorney in the civil division, a couple of days ago, Jules explained what she'll be doing.
This position is a new position for the U.S. Attorney's Office, so there's a little bit of, I think, creation involved. But my priority or my primary responsibility is going to be focused on civil rights enforcement. So what that means is there's a number of federal statutes that protect people's civil rights, and the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Vermont are empowered to enforce those statutes. And that's what I will be focusing on doing. The U.S. Attorney's Office here has done a bit of this work in the past, but this new position allows the office to devote new resources and just a lot more time to civil rights litigation.
Can you give me an example of the kinds of actual things you'd be working on? You know, maybe obviously you don't have to give us a real case, but something that would explain what that looks like.
Sure. So the suite of federal civil rights laws is really broad. Includes fair housing protections, fair lending protections, protections against employment discrimination, protections against patterns or practices, so kind of pervasive discrimination in law enforcement or in prisons. And so it really runs the gamut. It's almost, I think if you can think of a civil rights issue, there is probably a federal statute on point. And so we work in tandem with the Civil Rights Division in D.C. They have subject matter experts on all of these issues. So to kind of how it would kind of play out is if someone brought us a complaint or if we observed what we thought might be a civil rights violation, we'd investigate. Let's say someone says they were not allowed to rent an apartment because of their race. We might investigate what happened in that situation, if it's happened elsewhere, maybe in that apartment complex or something along those lines, and consider whether to open an investigation or a case there. But it really is a broad practice, and the priorities will be determined, I think, by what's going on here and what the community says the priorities are.
So are you actively, Colo, looking for community input to help shape this job?
Yeah, so, Jane, we've done a lot of outreach over the years. I've been in the office since about 2010 and worked in this area probably since about 2011. And throughout that time period, we've met with community members and interest groups that that are connected to civil rights. We've tried to do our homework in terms of the issues that seem to be affecting people the most. And we always feel like we should take our instructions from what we're hearing in the community, particularly in this area. And that outreach led us to apply for the position that Jules is now filling once the announcement from DOJ came up. So outreach is key to our civil rights effort. We've done it in the past. It's led to cases that we've had, and we'll continue to do that now.
Is this funding that could dry up with a new administration?
It's hard to speculate. I can't imagine. There's no history of AUSA positions being eliminated that I'm aware of. This is a permanent position. Just to give you a little background on our office, there's about 20 lawyers, and all of them, except for the U.S. attorney, are career positions. And those positions, once they're allocated to a district, unless there's a major nationwide reshuffling, stay where they are. So we have full expectation, just like all the other career lawyers in our office, that these positions will remain.
Jules, you grew up in Vermont. What made you want to come back and take this particular job here?
It was really the job that brought me back. I was in New York at a civil rights firm, and I saw this opportunity come up. It was really the opportunity to do civil rights work like I had been, but to do it in the context of my own home state. And really, I've always thought of Vermont as my own home. And then I met the office and the people in the office and saw how seriously they took civil rights litigation, how committed they had been to it, and how much of a, I think, robust practice they'd established for, as Colo mentioned, having four civil attorneys with a really heavy non-civil rights docket. So I came back, and I really couldn't be happier about it.
Given that this is a position that you have some ability to shape, since it's a new position, do you have priorities that you are hoping to work on?
Yeah, I think it would have been a little foolhardy to come in with specific subject matter priorities, especially, you know, I grew up here, but I haven't been back in a little while. And so my first step personally is to do a lot of outreach and a lot of just communication with the people who've been here doing the work for the past decades. I think Colo can speak perhaps to some of the priorities that have been identified through outreach in the past. I think those are the first obvious subject matter choices to focus on.
Like Jules said earlier, there's a wide array of federal civil rights laws, but it is true that through our outreach, we do hear about particular issues more than others. And I think it's fair to say that we hear quite a bit about housing discrimination. We hear about unequal treatment in schools. We hear about unequal treatment in interactions with law enforcement. And we hear quite a bit about discrimination against people with disabilities. So we've had a fair number of cases in the disability rights context that we've brought to closure. So we've, to some extent, addressed that area, and we'll continue to do so. And these other areas, you know, we're, as lawyers for DOJ, we sort of deal with what's in front of us, take what we're hearing in terms of priorities and go in those directions. So it's hard to predict, but our outreach efforts and conversations in the community have led us in those four areas.
Can you just, so that we have it clear, delineate when the U.S. Attorney's Office gets involved in something like housing discrimination, given that you're part of a federal agency, essentially, rather than, for example, the state's attorney getting involved in housing discrimination?
Yeah, it's not always clear-cut who gets involved. In some areas, the state protections are greater than the federal protections. In other areas, the federal protections are greater than the state protections. In the civil rights area, we work closely with the Vermont Human Rights Commission. We have a good relationship with them, along with Legal Aid. These are all community partners that we've established relationships with through our outreach to work together and to refer cases to each other as we hear about them, because sometimes they're more equipped than we are to handle something, and sometimes we're more equipped. An example is I did a bunch of ADA matters in Woodstock, Vermont, and I worked closely with an investigator from the Vermont Human Rights Commission.
ADA being the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yes, and that case came in through the Vermont Human Rights Commission. They identified that they didn't have the resources to do the kind of architectural work that was necessary to figure out whether or not there were violations. And we were able to bring resources to bear from DOJ to make that happen. And then the two of us closed out these matters. So there's different ways to approach these things, but we're always looking for those partnerships.
Immigration policy was a big issue in the recent presidential campaign. And since the election of Donald Trump, both Burlington and Winooski have been talking about their desire to be what are known as sanctuary cities, where somebody's legal status in the country is basically off the table in criminal proceedings or in interactions with law enforcement. Jules, do you anticipate immigration being an area of focus within civil rights that you would be addressing in this position?
I think when we talk about immigration, we're actually talking about a lot of different issues. I think people think of whether or not someone's being deported, whether or not their nationality or race or nation of origin is being taken into consideration in employment decisions or housing decisions. And that's really where we approach that issue from a civil rights angle. So there is a federal statute that protects against discrimination on the basis of national origin. And certainly if we received a complaint to that effect, that would be something that we would review and would look into. So that's the approach. That's how I think it might affect civil rights work in Vermont.
I think it's a good example to highlight, you know, with the situation in Rutland and the Syrian refugees that are supposed to arrive in the next month or so. Eric Miller, the U.S. attorney, and myself and our first assistant, Jeannie Coles, went down to Rutland a few weeks ago and met with the mayor and local law enforcement and some representatives of federal law enforcement to talk about preparing for that in the context of what kind of speech is protected by the First Amendment and what kind of speech is not protected by the First Amendment, and to give the folks down there a sort of a synopsis of hate crime laws and First Amendment protections, making clear that not all speech that is critical is a violation of the law. Clearly, the First Amendment is very strong, but also highlighting these federal statutes in the hate crime area so that the folks on the ground in Rutland can be better educated about how to deal with the kinds of inflammatory speech that they are seeing.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you were hoping that we would talk about this position or about the work being done at the U.S. Attorney's Office?
You know, I've heard this position be called the civil rights prosecutor position. And I mean, I think in a lot of ways that's accurate. But I think a great facet of the federal civil rights laws, or many of them, is they have built in a bit of an informal or collaborative process on the front end. And so while we have enforcement power of the civil rights statutes, I think the office also plans to approach many of these issues collaboratively or from the perspective of wanting to seek a solution to the problem. I also would love if people knew how to get in touch with us. The best way to get in touch with us is to fill out a form we have on our website, which is justice.gov/USAO-VT. You can fill out a form, email it, or mail it to us, and we review all of the forms that come in. And that has led to cases in the past, and we have every expectation it will continue to.
Julia Torti is the new assistant U.S. attorney in the Civil Division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Vermont. And Nicholas Crest, Colo Crest, heads the division and is also the Civil Rights Coordinator. They've been talking about Jules' new position, which is one of 34 such positions around the country dedicated to focusing on civil rights. Vermont journalist Theo Padnos spent 2 years in an Al-Qaeda prison in Syria. Now a documentary has been released about that long ordeal, and tomorrow on this program we'll speak with Padnos about his time as a prisoner, how he survived it, and what he learned from the experience. Send your questions or comments for Theo Padnos to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Also, if you're on Reddit, come ask me a question. I'm doing an AMA and Ask Me Anything on the Vermont subreddit from 2 to 4 p.m. tomorrow. I'm mostly worried that no one will ask me nothing, so please get on Reddit and ask me anything. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.